Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Gwendolyn Midlow Hall, author of Haunted by Slavery, A Southern White Woman in the Freedom Struggle. We'll also hear from Corey Ajmi about her story collection, Life and Other Shortcomings. Gwendolyn Midlow Hall is a celebrated Louisiana historian who brought us the landmark work Africans in Colonial Louisiana and is known for her work in digitizing slave records, a great service to public history. She is the author of several books, and today visitors to the Whitney Plantation can see her work etched in stone in the Allée Gwendolyn Midlow Hall. In her most recent book, she turns her historian's eye on herself. It's called Haunted by Slavery, A Memoir of a Southern White Woman in the Freedom Struggle, and it is a chronicle of a long and interesting life. That phrase, nevertheless she persisted, seems made for Gwendolyn Midlow Hall. She persisted in writing, in pursuing her education, in teaching, in raising a family, and making a difference. We're speaking to her today from her home in Guanajuato, Mexico. Gwen, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hello. Thank you very much for interviewing me.
Oh, my pleasure. There's so much to love in this book. But one part I particularly loved was the story of your New Orleans childhood. So talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. Well, New Orleans is a unique place. And the more I've learned and the more I've traveled and the more I've studied documents, the more impressed I am with the uniqueness of Louisiana culture, including New Orleans, of course.
And all along growing up here, you were developing the conscience of a radical or a revolutionary. You talk a little bit about your father in that way, and you say you have a sense of carrying on the family tradition in your work. Tell us about that tradition.
Well, this tradition came from the Eastern European Ashkenazi Jewish tradition of Eastern Europe. And it was mainly Poland and the Ukraine, part of Russia. My family came from different places. My father's family came from Upper Silesia, which was and still is an important transportation and manufacturing center, which is now part of Poland. He was born in Sosnowitz in 1902, and he came from a very large family. He was the 14th of 16 children. Only six of them survived childhood. And it was quite a miracle that he survived because he was born with a very bad case of rickets from malnutrition. Most of the children died of malnutrition in one form or another and crowding. But one thing about my family is that they had a socialist tradition. They were internationalist and devoted to the working class throughout the world. And they were anti-Zionist. They really opposed Zionists. And they opposed organized religion.
And they were such hard workers. That was the thing that struck me about your father, working as a tailor during the day and going to law school at night.
Yes, he was a very hard worker. In fact, when I was small, he would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, take a shower, get dressed, make sure everybody else in the household was awake and dressed. He needed their company, he said. And so he expected us all to work very hard and get a lot done. But the whole family had a social consciousness, and they were not at all thrilled by the racism that they ran into in New Orleans, which was just about everywhere, very powerful. My father encouraged me to work hard and to make something of myself.
Well,
even though he was very backward about women, so there was a conflict there. He had three daughters and one of them died very young. And I was the youngest after my little sister died. But my father said he had a special feeling for me because he thought I was his most intelligent child and the one who could best carry on his tradition of social commitment.
Well, all along, it seems to me, you had a sense of yourself being different. I remember once in an argument with the teacher said, "Oh, Gwendolyn, I thought you were a good girl." And you write, "I wasn't a good girl. I never was."
That's true. My mother was also a very intelligent, independent-minded woman. Now, she couldn't go beyond the bounds of what was expected of her, probably because she was of a generation older than I. But she really believed that women were absolutely equal to men. She never believed that men were any more intelligent or competent than women, except physically. And she taught me that women were just as good as men. Mm-hmm. But was supposed to hide it. So she tried to get me to adjust to the gender expectations of the society, but being conscious that they weren't true and they weren't right. I couldn't do that. I never adjusted to gender expectations, never in my life.
No, you were feisty from the get-go, I could tell.
She used to tell me, "Now, never let the boy know that you're more intelligent than he is."
Well, that's hard to do sometimes.
So I didn't pay a bit of attention to her.
You've literally had a front row seat to changing times. You were on the platform when W.E.B. Du Bois came to Columbia, South Carolina, for the Southern Negro Youth Conference to make a speech called "Behold the Land," the 70th anniversary of the Southern Negro Youth Conference. And you write that that was the first time you understood the power of history.
I had studied a bit of history in school, in elementary school and in high school, and I didn't believe a word of it. You know, it was extremely racist history that really disparaged African Americans and taught us that they were inferior and that they couldn't learn because they were stupid and they were dangerous because they were violent, and that if we didn't keep them down through terror, they would treat us the way we treated them. And that's what we were taught. I didn't believe any of that. By the time I was 16, I helped organize and join an interracial youth movement in New Orleans. I think, as far as I can tell, it was the only one in the South. That was in 1945, right after World War II ended. That's why I went to this conference and I was elected an executive board member, and that's why they put me on the stage right behind W.E.B. Du Bois. And so I heard his speech, which is a wonderful speech. I insisted that it be put on the web, and it is on the web now, so you can read it. But he was an amazing man, and he believed in the strength and power of the African-American community, but he never hated white people. In fact, he was quite open to Southern whites. He believed that they were exploited too, and that the only way was to have unity and to struggle for democracy in the South. And it was closely tied up with the international movement against colonialism. Mm-hmm. So you need to read that speech, because he begged talented young people and there were mainly African Americans there, but he begged all of us not to desert the South. He begged us to remain in the South. He says the South belongs to us. There was also a speech by Herbert Aptheker, who had recently published a book called American Negro Slave Revolts. And when I was growing up, they just taught me that slaves just loved slavery and they loved their slave masters and they never lifted a finger against slavery. And somehow, you know, they were passive and cowardly and all kinds of reasons. They said that the only conspiracy against slavery was the 1795 one in Pointe-Coupée. And they said that it was to kill the white men and grab the white women so that they could rape the white women. That's what I was taught in school. And I didn't believe a word of it. And as I got older, I wanted to at least see what the document said. And of course, the documents didn't say anything like that.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Gwendolyn Midloe Hall, author of Haunted by Slavery, A Southern White Woman in the Freedom Struggle. Now, we're at a time when, you know, I get new books about slavery all the time. We're seeing tremendous scholarship being done in this area now. I'm curious what you think we still need to know. What areas are left for research and investigation?
Oh, there's a lot out there. There's just so much. In fact, I have a project now. I'm working with Kathy Hambrick to complete the Louisiana Slave Database. So the one that I did and published back in the year 2000 just ended with 1820. But of course, most of the slaves were there much later during the antebellum period. And I didn't begin to have the resources to continue it beyond 1820. But now that's changing. And after all these years, funding agencies and scholars, leading scholars, are beginning to appreciate my database. And let me tell you, that database is so complex and voluminous that it's almost like artificial intelligence for history.
Oh, wow. So how did you feel when you finished this book and you look back at all the things you'd done? You know, this was the life you couldn't have imagined when you were a girl. I mean, did you kind of sit back and go, whoa, I've done some stuff, you know? I mean,
well, you know, to tell you the truth, Susan, it's only now in my life when the few really advanced professors and writers about the African diaspora, just a handful of them, the most prestigious now, are beginning to appreciate the work I did, and perhaps I'm doing, I don't know.
So.
Yeah, and am doing too. It took so long for me to get this little recognition that I'm getting that my main reaction is, I sure am lucky I lived to be so old, or I never would have gotten any recognition in my lifetime.
Finally, justification, right? Now, one of the things I loved, you described in this book a writer's dream of a moment, and it's after Africans in Colonial Louisiana came out, and you got on the streetcar, and everybody was reading your book.
Well, you know, I'm still amazed that it became such a popular book, because I don't think it's a bit easy to read, and it's long, you know, it's long, it's complicated. Been telling people that, and they say, but it means so much to us. Mm-hmm. It's so original. It makes us look entirely at Louisiana entirely different.
Well, I was having dinner with a friend of mine who's a bookseller the other night, and I told her that story. And she said, that was the book that broke everything open, because everybody did read that book. So let's hope that you come back to New Orleans and get on a streetcar and everybody's reading this book. So,
oh, that would be very nice.
That would be great.
Yeah, well, I must tell you that That book, Africans in Colonial Louisiana, was published in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk to people now on the phone and on the web, young people, you know, the new generation who are reading Africans in Colonial Louisiana, and they talk about, oh, what a great experience and how much they've learned from it. And I said, this book was published long before you were born. I said, well, we know, but there's no other book like it.
That's right. And you've written now all these books that live on, which is what a writer does. We've been talking with Gwendolyn Midloe Hall, whose new book is Haunted by Slavery, a memoir of a Southern white woman in the freedom struggle. Gwen, thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have anything to do with you, Susan.
Oh, thank you. Corey Adjemi's award-winning fiction and personal essays have appeared in dozens of publications, including North American Review, Indiana Review, South Dakota Review, HuffPost, Man Repeller, Motherwell, Kveller, and others. Her collection of short stories, Life and Other Shortcomings, won an American Fiction Award and was a Best Book Awards finalist. Corey grew up in New Orleans and now lives in New York City. Corey Adjemi, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, several of these stories are memorably set in a New Orleans childhood. So what do you think some of the gifts growing up here gave you as a writer?
Oh, so much. New Orleans is such a rich place. The music, there's a liveliness, there's an energy. And I think I was very fortunate to be able to tap into those things and put those elements on the page.
Do you think you had to leave to write about them?
I don't know, because I left when I was still pretty young. I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine I would have always wanted to write about New Orleans because it's such a special place. But I do see in other areas of my writing how I have needed distance.
Right.
But I live in New York City now, and I write about New York City all the time. So I think it might have been something that would have still worked out for me.
Now, I love that these stories are interconnected. I always enjoy, you know, when characters pop up in another story. And two of the characters, Callie and Willow, are just standouts. So would you describe them and the process of creating them?
Sure. Well, the first thing that came to mind when you said that was I was really inspired by Margaret Atwood's book, The Cat's Eye. The relationship between the two protagonists, the two main characters, was intriguing to me. And I had some similar experiences in childhood, as I guess many people have. I don't really know. But I think that female bond, early friendship, where one person is maybe stronger than the other or kind of leading the way, is somewhat familiar. And that dynamic really interests me. So I started to play around with that dynamic, and those characters came to life.
And what about them appeals to you?
In general, I like to write about relationships and the depth. I like to think about them psychologically, what makes them tick, and what makes people tick. And I think power struggles mm-hmm. are something that I return to again and again, whether it's in marriage or friendship. And I think that's probably something that drew me in.
And there's a lot of dark humor there. There's always a lot of dark humor between women, I think. We have a way of talking to each other when we're alone, you know. Now, so many of these stories are about desire and its fulfillment, or lack thereof. And I remember that line, this wasn't the life she wanted, but it was the life she got. So talk about whether you see yourself as an optimist or a pessimist or somewhere in between with humorous thrown in.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so I think that I thought of myself as an optimist for a long time. And at some point maybe began to see things a little bit differently with a more critical eye or a negative spin. And maybe now I'm even at a place where it's a little more balanced. But because I had started out so optimistic and so almost unaware of a lot of realities, it took kind of swinging all the way back the other way to gain some perspective and now I think more balance.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jewish life is also very important in these stories, and there's one really revelatory story, The Devil Makes Three. And it's about a woman, and it includes the only real description of a mikveh, the ritual bath, that I've ever read. So talk about writing that. What was that like for you?
It's interesting because I really like reading about other cultures and traditions and rituals from all over the world. And so I wanted to be able to bring this Jewish tradition to the page and to readers and try not to bring too much of my own perspective or opinion about it and more present it. And yet my character does have a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed to be respectful about it and also honest about it. And so it was challenging to bring it to the page in a way that could be seen as both beautiful and maybe hard for some women to accept.
Well, this was a book that was all ready to go. It was on so many anticipated book lists. Parade named it one of the best beach books to look forward to in 2020. You were published by She Writes, which is doing such interesting books. And then pandemic. So what was it like for you trying to get the word out that year?
So, of course, it was originally somewhat frightening after all these years of having this dream.
Yeah.
And then realizing I wasn't going to be able to talk in front of readers and promote my book as I would have liked to and sign it in front of people and, you know, have this conversation in person. So the initial, you know, impact was pretty scary. But in retrospect, it hasn't been that bad. I've learned to use Zoom. I have conversations like this one all the time. And talking about my book has actually been a very added special bonus that I didn't expect to love as much not being in person. And having conversations like this have really been fine. And so promoting it has been different than it would have been without the pandemic, but it's proven to be fine. And also selling books, I think people are reading more books. I think book sales are okay during the pandemic.
Right.
People are home and they're reading.
Don't you love that people rediscovered reading? I mean, it was like, Thank you. Books have been here all along.
Nice about life and other shortcomings that kind of worked out also was people in the beginning were having a hard time with reading. Nobody could focus. They couldn't concentrate. People were scared. And then by the time Life and Other Shortcomings came out in August, people were maybe beginning to want to read something, but didn't want to commit to a long novel, didn't feel like they could stay focused. So Life and Other Shortcomings, with the being that it was somewhat short stories, it was an easier read. And yet it still had a novel feel because the stories connected. And so you could follow the characters from beginning to end and get a bigger, longer trajectory than if it was just short stories, separate short stories.
Oh, it has a wonderful arc. That was really so much of the pleasure of it. And so many women say that's why they write short stories, because that's what they have time for in family life.
Well, I do think that's why I started writing short stories. I mean, it was also just a great way to begin. And that's how it was. It was one story at a time. After my first one, I was like, do I think I can do a second one? Let's see what happens. And it was really one at a time, a building process.
Well, you've built something really fun to read. I mean...
Thank you.
Oh, we've been talking with Corey Ajmi, whose most recent book is the short story collection Life and Other Shortcomings. You can meet her when she appears in a virtual conversation with Constance Adler, Thursday, June 3rd at 4 p.m. To register, go to nolalibrary.org. Corey, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, poet Caroline Rowe launches her new collection, God's Favorite Redhead, Sunday, May 30th from 4 to 5:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Tickets required, available via Eventbrite. Kent Wascom will be the guest Monday, May 31st at 5 at Virtual Happy Hour, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Margalee Fox discusses her book, The Confidence Men, how two prisoners of war engineered the most remarkable escape in history, in a virtual conversation with journalist John Pope, Wednesday, June 2nd at 7. For more info, go to octaviabooks.com. Corey Ajmi, whose most recent book is a short story collection, Life and Other Shortcomings, appears in a virtual conversation with Constance Adler, Thursday, June 3rd at 4 p.m. To register, go to nolalibrary.org. Matthew Mosley signs his book, Ignition, Superior Communication Strategies to Create Stronger Connections, Friday, June 4th at 6. This is a ticketed event. Tickets available at gardendistrictbookshop.com. Poet Kelly Harris, author of Freedom Knows My Name, appears in a sidewalk book signing Saturday, June 5th from 2 to 3:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.